Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Andrew Jackson was a fighter. He was the hero of the War of 1812. When he assumed the presidency in 1829, he was ready to battle. He took on special interests and big money. He flexed America's military muscle. He gave voice to the common man. He also drove slaves and exiled Indians, sharply expanded presidential powers, and imposed an iron will on the country. Newsweek's John Meacham unpacks Old Hickory's colorful legacy in a big new biography. This hour on Point, The Age of Jackson. You can join the conversation. What do you know about the man behind the face on the $20 bill? Can you imagine a commander-in-chief who grew up ready to duel? What can we learn here as a new president takes the stage? Joining me now from New York is John Meacham, editor of Newsweek. He's author of the New York Times bestsellers Franklin and Winston, An Intimate Portrait of an Epic Friendship, and American Gospel, God, the Founding Fathers, and the Making of a Nation. His new biography is American Lion, Andrew Jackson in the White House. John Meacham, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks, Tom.
I expect we're going to hear a lot about the imprint that this man left on the country and the presidency, but I wish you'd just introduce us first to Andrew Jackson, the man. He grew up in a very different time, and it's quite a colorful coming up.
He did indeed. My view is that any president who attempts to attack his own assassin is worth a book.
Give us the details of that, just for starters. Where, how, what, with
well,
what?
Well, it was the last day of January, 1835. Jackson ruled from 1829 to 37. He's walking out of the Capitol after a funeral service for a congressman from South Carolina. He's coming out of the rotunda. An unemployed, deranged house painter comes up to him with two percussion pistols. Both fail to fire, although both are aimed at Jackson, and he pulls the trigger. Part of it was the moisture in the air that day. Yeah. Jackson leaps at the man and has to be pulled off him before he's hustled off. So that's the sort of man we're dealing with. One of the reasons I wanted to call the book American Lion is Jackson had two impulses. One was to be a protector, to defend the country, defend the Union against all comers. But he also had a predatory streak. And if you were not on his side, you could not run fast enough across the plains to escape him. He was an orphan, never knew his father, like Obama, like Bill Clinton. He grew up really without a central organizing authority figure. And I think his reaction to that, particularly once his mother died in the American Revolution tending to the sick, was to always seek positions of authority and responsibility. One of the things he loved to say was, "I take the responsibility." In an era in which we have politicians who all too rarely say that, Jackson was someone who always wanted to be the central figure, the man who could be counted on in a given situation.
Orphaned at age 14, he said, "I have been tossed upon the waves of fortune." Born in South Carolina, what was the geography of his early years like? He lost his, as you say, his mother in the Revolutionary War, his brothers as well. Mm-hmm. Where was this happening with Andrew Jackson?
Well, this was all in that brutal guerrilla combat down in South Carolina. We forget. The Revolution, I think, tends to be seen as Bunker Hill, crossing the Delaware, and then it was all kind of over. But there was really ferocious hand-to-hand combat and civilian populations fighting each other on the Tory and Whig sides. Jackson was a Whig. He was a rebel. He was a messenger for the Revolutionary Army. He was witness to a massacre, a terrible massacre of civilians there in the upper part of South Carolina. And really it never left him in several ways, figuratively and literally. He was a prisoner of war at the age of 14. He refused to shine a British officer's boots. That British officer hit him over the head with a saber. It left a gash the length and width of a man's finger in Jackson's head, a scar he carried, obviously, the rest of his life. He was someone who understood early on that you had to fight for what you wanted. And there was both the familial aspect of that, which we just discussed, mm-hmm. about having to, as Senator Obama said to me this summer when we were talking about his own upbringing, he said that one of the lessons he had from not having a father around was that he had to raise himself. Jackson was like that. And he was had a terrible temper as a young man. A neighborhood boy later told a 19th century biographer that you'd wrestle with Andy and you'd throw him once and you'd throw him twice and you'd throw him three times and you'd throw him four times, but Andy would just never stay throwed, and he never did.
He would never stay throwed. He went from that, orphaned POW in the Revolutionary War to an enormous hero in the War of 1812 and of course, all out of the Battle of New Orleans, 1815, which has been called one of the most epic sort of naval battles between Trafalgar or epic battles period between Trafalgar and Stalingrad, as our Walter Russell Mead called it once.
It was our Agincourt. We lost only about 13 men. The British lost 300. Jackson said as he looked out across the field at New Orleans as the morning mist rose, many British officers were getting up because they'd hidden under fallen comrades mm-hmm. to save their lives. He said he'd never had such a vision of the resurrection as he had on that day. It was an enormous popular event, and we've lost it, I think, at this distance. But January 8th used to be essentially a national holiday. There were Jackson Parade. That was the anniversary of the battle. Mm-hmm. There were Jackson parades. There were Jackson feasts. There were songs written about him. His image was widely disseminated in a era when visual culture was so important because there were so few mass
images around. Visual.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Mm-hmm. Jackson later kept a portrait painter at the White House living upstairs with him. So it'd be like having a YouTube videographer at
paint
hand.
Paint me now. Paint me again.
Let's post this. So he was a figure of enormous popularity, particularly to those who served with him. He was given the name Old Hickory for being tough as hickory wood during the War of 1812 when he had led a lot of Tennessee troops down toward New Orleans. They'd received an order to go back. Many of the men were sick. Many were having a hard time fitting on wagons. Troop doctor came to Jackson and said, "What are we to do?" And he said, "To do, sir, you're to leave no man behind." Mm-hmm. And the doctor said, "Well, we don't have enough room." He said, "Well, then all the officers shall give up their horses." And he was the first person to get off his horse and give it to a sick man. And they watched him just relentlessly against the elements, against the odds, stand strong. And in that culture of mm-hmm. that time, I don't want to be too romantic about it, mm-hmm. but we've lost to some extent in an industrialized society and an increasingly information economy. We've lost the sense of how tactile and how important physical stamina and strength would have been to people in the early 19th century.
He was tender at that moment, giving up his horse. But, I mean, this was a man who massacred Native Americans in combat, fought duels aplenty, put martial law in New Orleans, as you've written, executed deserters in his ranks and British subjects after he, as you put it, preemptively invaded Florida in 1818. I mean, he would crack the whip, too.
Let there be no doubt. I am not lionizing Andrew Jackson. One of the reasons
Your
was
book's called American
it,
Lion.
It is, but that's we explain that. Lions are not always noble. Lions are ferocious, and I depend on readers with an appreciation of nuance. Mm-hmm. I think that the reason I wanted to write about him is he represents the best of us and the worst of us. He represents fundamental contradictions and complexities in the American character that are perennial. Here is a nation dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. Those lines that Jefferson wrote in that boarding house in Philadelphia. And yet we have the twin tragedies of slavery, of the removal and the massacre of Native Americans right at the heart of the American experience. It took us a long time to work our way through those evil forces that we unleashed and we cultivated and allowed to shape our national life. Jackson is no hero in some sort of un-nuanced, absolutely heroic sense. Neither's Abraham Lincoln. Lincoln was against emancipation until he was for it. My view is if we were to only try to recover and learn about people who represented a kind of unnuanced good in the past, first of all, there'd be no one to recover. Damn few to write about.
Right.
But I think that great leaders teach by their derelictions as much as by their triumphs. And if Arthur Schlesinger, who generously advised me and was a good friend and obviously the author of The Great Age of Jackson, he used to say that self-righteousness in retrospect is easy, also cheap. And I think there's a lot to that. Mm-hmm. I think that before we spend a great deal of moral energy condemning sins of the past, we should take stock of the inequalities and injustices of our own time and always wonder, you know, what will my six-year-old, what will my four-year-old ultimately say of me? You know, how could you have been part of a generation that didn't provide health care as a basic human right? How could you allow what goes on in Darfur to go on? And I think we learn that by studying the past, that one generation's accepted good is another generation's clear evil.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the people's president, Old Hickory, Andrew Jackson, and his stamp on the country and the American presidency. My guest is John Meacham, editor of Newsweek magazine. You may have read his Franklin and Winston or American Gospel. His new book is American Lion, Andrew Jackson in the White House. John Meacham joins me from New York. And, John, I want to get to that big stamp of the Age of Jackson, but I wish you'd give us the cook's quick tour from the end of that war where he's tenderly giving up his horse and ordering other officers to do the same for wounded troops, to his time in the White House. How did he make that great leap from military preeminence to political preeminence?
Well, it was a moderately quick journey. It was about 13 years, but in a weird way, it was 9 years. I am a Tennessean. Mm-hmm. I do not know what it is about Democratic nominees from Tennessee who managed to win the popular vote but lose it ultimately in presidential politics.
Hello,
Al. Exactly. We have two of them. He fought a number of Indian wars. He added tens of millions of acres to the United States. He served in the United States Senate from Tennessee in an interesting way, sort of as a way of cleaning up his reputation to some extent. Mm-hmm. He had invaded Florida, as we talked about, in 1818. That had led to a large, contentious congressional investigation. He had fought earlier in his life I shouldn't say wonderfully dramatic, but it really was a gunfight, a brawl in Nashville with Jesse Benton and Thomas Hart Benton, a name that we don't know much anymore, but a senator from Missouri. Mm-hmm. Jackson got one of those bullets in his arm. He bled through two mattresses. He ordered the doctor not to amputate the
arm. We need some detail here. You said gunfight. Was this a duel or something else?
It was a brawl. There had been a source of contention between a friend of Jackson's and Jesse Benton, a brother of Thomas Hart Benton. Mm-hmm. And it's a little like why did God turn on Saul in favor of David? It has befuddled scholars for millennia trying to figure out exactly what it was that led to this. But there was an episode of Bonanza.
Jackson right in the thick of it and taking a bullet.
And somebody tried to kill him with a dirk knife. And all this is unfolding in the streets of Nashville, Tennessee. But in a sign of what I think makes Jackson so interesting as opposed to simply an interesting character, is he goes to Washington as a senator and makes friends, befriends Thomas Hart Benton, who becomes his greatest advocate in the United States Senate throughout his presidency. And in fact, John Eaton, a colleague of his, wrote back to Rachel saying how pleased she would have been, Mrs. Jackson, at how Jackson was putting old enmities to rest in the early part of the 1820s.
You mentioned his wife, Rachel. We'd better get a little sense of his love story before we get to the presidency, because it comes back to play a pretty significant role. There's a drama here.
Absolutely. He fell in love with Rachel Donelson Robards in the 1790s. She was a daughter of one of the great pioneer families of Tennessee, a family that had come across the Cumberland and settled Nashville. Mm-hmm. There was a slight complication. She was at that point married to someone else. Mm. And Jackson, who never let anything stand in his way, did not allow that to stand in his way. They fell deeply in love. They believed, as they were going off to get married in Natchez, Mississippi, mm-hmm. that the divorce had been granted. As it turned out, it had not been. So Mrs. Jackson was, strictly speaking, a bigamist for a number of years before it was all straightened out. In terms of the manners and morals and the culture of the frontier in the late 18th century, that was not as wild as it sounds, because of the amount of time it took, legal proceedings and that sort of thing. It was very different when Jackson, a quarter century later, was running for national office. And Mrs. Jackson was attacked by Jackson's foes as a bigamist and a whore. She was bitterly denounced, saying that there were charges she was unfit to live in the White House. Jackson believed that the cumulative stress of those attacks led to her collapse and death between his election in 1828 and his mm-hmm. inauguration. She collapsed on the 17th of December, 1828, died on the 22nd, and they buried her on Christmas Eve before he moved to Washington. And he never really recovered from it. He kept her Isaac Watts' Book of Psalms by his bed at all times, a cameo of her, and spoke of her with a kind of tenderness and a kind of devotion that I think can only suggest a kind of deep and abiding true love.
John, Jackson has faded a bit from popular imagination, but it hasn't always been faded. You're bringing him back right now with American Lion. But I happen to have a clip here, a little clip on just this point from a 1953 film, The President's Lady, about the courtship and marriage and the whole sort of scandal here to Rachel Donelson. It starred Charlton Heston and Susan Hayworth. Here's just a few seconds of a scene where Rachel learns she's finally getting that divorce from her first husband, but with a price.
How did he get the divorce?
Rachel.
What were the grounds?
Andrew,
what were the grounds?
He accuses you of adultery.
With whom?
He names me.
Bum, ba-dum, bum. Once it was the stuff of movies, John, but he took that pain and no doubt anger over that to the White House with him.
He did, and he always blamed a rotating cast of his enemies: John Quincy Adams, Henry Clay, John C. Calhoun, depending on sort of where his mind was at any given moment. But the most important political impact it had was he saw in a separate struggle with involving the wife of his Secretary of War. Who was a woman who I suspect was not all she should have been in terms of her sexual morality, although it's impossible to know at this distance, and mm-hmm. it was hard to know even then. I know this sounds a little crazy, but for those who doubt that a scandal over a woman can lead to an epic struggle, I submit the Trojan War for your consideration.
Yes, duly noted.
Or the Rape of the Lock. Mm-hmm. John Eaton, Jackson's great friend, and who had defended him against charges about the Florida matter back in the late 18-teens, married on New Year's Day, between the election and the inauguration, married a daughter of a Washington tavern keeper about whom there were many rumors about how hospitable she actually was to her father.
How very hospitable, yes.
Precisely. And again, just think about the Iliad. Whether one received Mrs. Eaton, this way, as she became,
in Washington,
or did not, became a litmus test for whether you were pro-Jackson or anti-Jackson. As Daniel Webster said, it is hard to believe that in a great republic, the question of the presidential succession is to be determined by a scandal over a woman. But in fact, it was. And there was a struggle between Martin Van Buren and John C. Calhoun to see who would be the successor to Jackson. And Van Buren sided with Mrs. Eaton, and John C. Calhoun did not. And I submit to you, you can see who won.
Andrew Jackson would not hear of her being excluded. And in a way, this takes us right to one of the biggest themes of all around Jackson and the age of Jackson, the sort of rise of the common man and his role in that. Take us up a couple of notches, if you would, John, to how Andrew Jackson reconceived the U.S. presidency, the place of the people in that conception, and the place of the president himself.
Well, we forget sometimes that the founders created a republic, not a democracy. And a good bit of the Federalist Papers are, in fact, arguments about where power should reside. Before Jackson, the first six presidents tended toward the Republican lowercase r model. The intermediary institutions of a Senate appointed by state legislatures, of an electoral college, of a House of Representatives that would decide disputed presidential elections, which I should say quickly, that's what happened in 1824. In 1824, Jackson wins the popular vote, wins a plurality. The election goes to the House, and John Quincy Adams and Henry Clay joined forces to elect Adams. To Jackson, that was what he called a corrupt bargain, that the people's will had been thwarted. And he determined from that moment forward in 1825, he determined from that moment forward that he would avenge that loss on behalf of the people and on behalf of himself. So fast forward to 1828-29 as he's coming to power. He is the first self-made man to become president, the first true figure. It's a little like President-elect Obama in that he's the first.
Not the scion of a plantation or a moneyed family or a prominent family.
No. He was a wealthy man, but he had fought his way up from nothing. And he was the common people, the suffrage was expanding. The right to vote was expanding. The number of people who were able to vote in 1828 was the highest ever. They saw themselves in him. And they saw that path of upward mobility. What Jackson wanted to do, and I don't want to torture this metaphor, but if you consider that the script of American public life, as written by Madison and Hamilton and Adams and the other framers, was one in which the people were essentially in the audience of the theater, to be consulted, to play a role, but not a central role. Jackson wanted to rewrite that script to put them at center stage. And he believed that the people, as a broad whole, were less susceptible to corruption than institutions like
elites.
And elites, either financial or political. And his sense of himself as president is incredibly important because it's the model that Lincoln, Theodore Roosevelt, FDR, Truman, Reagan, and others used. He believed and said, and it's remarkable that he was the first president to make this assertion, but he was, that he was, as president, the direct representative of the American people, the only direct representative of all the American people. He saw himself as the interpreter and enactor of the public will, and that he would stand amid these elites, amid these houses of Congress, amid these courts, amid these private interests, and he would represent the many against the few. Now, that suggests no lack of ego, but it also created what I would call the modern presidency. what Lincoln did when he needed an example of a president who had stood strong for union and against secession, mm-hmm. which Jackson had done against South Carolina in a crisis during his administration. He sent for Jackson's paper on that issue. Lincoln was writing his first inaugural in that terrible winter of 1861, and he asked for a copy of the Constitution, a copy of Webster's second reply to Hayne, a copy of Henry Clay's speech on the Compromise of 1850, and Andrew Jackson's proclamation of the people of South Carolina.
Because Jackson had been afraid that the Union might be breaking up then.
He absolutely was. In fact, what that proclamation said was that the noblest title anyone could have was a citizen of the United States, not being a South Carolinian or a Tennessean or a Pennsylvanian, but being an American. That view of a broad, centralized, and actually unified is a better word than centralized, mm-hmm. a unified America was something that inspired Lincoln. T.R. explicitly said that he was of the Jackson-Lincoln school of executive power. He admired Jackson's instinct for the jugular, as he put it, and said that no man other than Washington and Lincoln had left a deeper mark upon the country. Franklin Roosevelt was borderline obsessed with Jackson in many ways. He saw him as a forerunner of the kind of economic populist that he himself aspired to be in the New Deal.
To grab the power of the presidency and use it for the broad mass.
Yes, that the mystery and the majesty, and I don't mean to be too gooey about this, mm-hmm. but in fact there is something majestic about it. That a man in a moment can meet, as Whitman said of Lincoln, that there can be a moment in which the president as an individual can summon the will of the people, can marshal it in a way that ultimately advances the cause of the country and the cause of liberty. And for all of Jackson's manifold sins and wickednesses, and they were manifold, he did keep the possibility of progress alive. If the Union had fallen apart in 1832-33, which it could have done.
This is when radicals in Charleston were raising an army to defend South Carolina's right to nullify federal laws. He said no. He said disunion by armed force is treason, he wrote.
And he underscored it.
Treason.
When he was drafting the proclamation, he was in his office on the second floor of the White House, now the Lincoln bedroom, mm-hmm. and he had a stand-up desk, partly because it was so painful for him to sit down. And a witness came in and later reported that they saw the ink glistening on the paper, the foolscap, as he was drafting this, because he was writing so rapidly mm-hmm. and with such passion. I have a view of this, which is that one of the reasons he was so passionate about the Union is that his family's blood had consecrated the Union. And I use that language quite deliberately.
In the Revolutionary War.
Yeah. I mean, mm-hmm. he lost mm-hmm. everything. Mm-hmm. His mother had died tending to the sick in Charleston. His brothers had died in combat. He had damn near died in mm-hmm. combat. So if the Union were simply a provisional thing, if it were a temporary expedient, then the things that he had lost, that line you quoted a moment ago, the things that were dearest to him, would have died in vain, and that he could not abide. He could not abide that thought.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're joined today by the editor of Newsweek magazine, John Meacham, who is out with a big, new, wonderful biography of Andrew Jackson. It's called American Lion, Andrew Jackson in the White House. We've got Tennesseans lined up here, and then we'll come north. But let's go first to Nashville and William. William, you're on the air with John Meacham.
Thank you, Tom. Hello.
Hello.
And thanks a lot for your optimism in the news roundup, by the way.
Sure, least I could do.
But anyway, Mr. Meacham, I've been to the Hermitage, the home of Andrew Jackson, three times, and I'm kind of hoping that I don't have any more friends or relatives coming down wanting to see it. But anyway, I really, for not wanting to romanticize him, you're doing a pretty good job. And I think that the first thing, and I'm sure a lot of people want to talk about this, is the case of the Indian removal in the Cherokee Nation. And if I've got it straight, the Cherokee Nation actually played by our U.S. constitutional rules and went to the Supreme Court, in fact, and won. At which point, Andrew Jackson said, well, I don't really care. We're just going to remove the Indians from Georgia and North Carolina and Tennessee, and did so, which I think might weigh heavily on us right now. I hope it does. But anyway, what price did he pay, and what does that mean for, you know, our current administration, the incoming administration? If you lose in Congress, if you lose in the Supreme Court, just do what you want. I don't really care much about his personality. I stipulate that he was a tenacious and tough guy.
Mm-hmm.
But I would rather that the nation win and play by some rules that make sense for everybody.
William, let us pick those up. And you raise, of course, a couple of great themes of John Meacham's book. John, not everyone will know this history as well as William, who's been to the Hermitage so often. I wish you'd introduce us to Andrew Jackson's tumultuous relationship with Native Americans. Give us some of that history, in particular the Cherokees and the Trail of Tears. And then he alludes to this sort of imperial presidency, I will do what I damn well please kind of notion.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. There is no excusing. There's only explaining the twin tragedies at the heart of, I think, Jackson's life and career, and I think that of the nation's, which is Indian removal and his unrepentant view on slaveholding. He did exactly the wrong thing about the Indians at every turn, in my view. He made the Indian removal, a bill for Indian removal, the centerpiece of his first couple of years in the White House.
And was this from Georgia, North Carolina, Tennessee, as William says? Give us some of the sketch, the outline of what he was,
it's
populations
exactly,
and what he was looking at.
It's Cherokees, it's Seminoles, it's the tribes that. Where it basically was most important was where the land was valuable, not surprisingly. And so that was in Georgia, that was in Alabama, that we fought a long war in the Second Seminole War, one of the longest in our history that no one remembers, that was over removal. So this was basically clearing out the American South for really quite greedy white potential landowners who wanted to expand a plantation economy. I mean, it actually combines the two horrors in one package.
Mm-hmm.
White people wanted the land in order to build plantations which would be worked by slaves. So it is, again, there's just nothing to be said.
And this was the forcible removal, the kind of exile, the Trail of Tears that took these mm-hmm. tribes, populations where?
West of the Mississippi,
mm-hmm.
and then further west and further west, and
Oklahoma.
That long and dismal history. The only thing that can be said about this is it was a long and dismal history that began about 1622 when there were massacres around Jamestown, and John Quincy Adams, James Monroe, other presidents, Jefferson, all were perplexed and flummoxed by what they saw as the problem. The case of the Cherokees is particularly painful because the Cherokee Indians did, the Cherokee Nation, did everything that white America asked of it.
Mm-hmm.
It created an alphabet, for God's sake, Sequoia. Mm-hmm. It had a newspaper. It was quite a stable society there, quite near where I grew up in North Georgia mm-hmm. and eastern Tennessee. And it didn't matter to Jackson. It didn't matter, I would argue, by extension, it didn't argue to enough people in the country to stop Jackson from doing what he did.
Was it a personal animus? Was it straight-up racism?
It was greed and national security with a patina of paternalism. To unpack that very quickly, they wanted the land. period. And gold was discovered on Cherokee land near Dahlonega, Georgia in the early 1830s, late 1820s, early 1830s, which is guaranteed that sealed the fate. So there was greed for the land. Mm. Jackson believed that having Native Americans as a loose, uncontrollable factor in his view in the mainland, in the homeland, as potential allies for invading or foreign forces, the Spanish, the British, was unacceptable. So that was the national security part of his argument. And then there was this paternalistic, I think wrong, but very real in Jackson's mind, view that their great father, as he referred to himself, wanted what was best for them and that he would save his children by sending them west where they could thrive. It makes our skin crawl today. It's reprehensible. But it is something that the nation as a whole ultimately allowed to happen. And I don't think there's anything redemptive to say about Jackson on this, and I want to be very clear about that.
We'll come to the imperial presidency angle, but let me get another call here from Nashville. And Alex, you're on the air with John Meacham.
I am on the air.
Yes, sir.
Good day. It's curious to me that having lived in Virginia for a good part of my life, but being from Tennessee and living in Nashville now, Virginia has, the part of Virginia where I live, has Jefferson, and Jefferson is so revered and talked about and thought about and enters into conversation, and his shadow is huge. And Jackson, who's the man who, through his victory at New Orleans, made Europe acknowledge us, and he beat the greatest army in the world that had just wreaked havoc in the lowlands under British rule, and that Jackson just doesn't have a big presence at all in the mind's eye of people from Middle Tennessee and Nashville. It's so different.
Jefferson, such a larger image after all this time, a larger figure.
Yeah.
John, what do you make of that?
I think that's true. I think that part of the question is – part of the issue is there is this expanse of history called the Middle Period by professionals between the drama of the founding and the crisis of the Civil War. And Jefferson is so much part of the drama of the founding, one of the three or four most vivid characters. And then in many ways, the popular mind zips ahead to Fort Sumter. It's almost as though, you know, even poor James Madison, you know, he can't get a statue at Epcot. If you can't do that, you write the Constitution and you can't do that, what else do you have to do? So there's this – I think that what happens is really from Jefferson to Lincoln, there's kind of a caesura in historical consciousness. Part of the reason I wanted to do this book is to look at exactly that. This is the age of the makings of our modern democracy for all, with its triumphs and its tragedies.
What do you mean by that?
The expansion of the suffrage, the beginnings of a popular media culture that we would begin to recognize, the explosion of religiosity. Once we deregulated religion in this country, it took off. The last church to disestablish was Massachusetts in 1833, right at the center of Jackson's year, Jackson's presidency. You had the beginnings of debates about birth control. There was a 3 or 4 or 5 day debate between an evangelical and an atheist that went around the country. It was a little like Christopher Hitchens debating Rick Warren. So you had we would recognize these conversations. We would be able to, I think, feel our way through the age of Jackson in a way that we would not be able to with the founding era. And I think that Jackson's contribution, and it's – you can debate whether it's good or bad, but it's undeniable. He shifted the terms of the conversation and of the political debate away from entrenched elites and more toward the popular will. And yes, he defended the planter class, and the broad whole is often quickly turns into different special interests. Mm-hmm. But the voice of the people became a more significant factor in the life of the country because Jackson was president.
Let's go to Bill in Northborough, Massachusetts. Hi, Bill. You're on the air with John Meacham.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Your book definitely lays Jackson bare. One particular personal observation is that whenever I look at historical figures, I expect them to be blemished. But I always look for the capacity for personal growth. I saw that in, for example, Washington. I definitely saw it in Lincoln, people like Harry Truman. And by the way, as a little aside, an imperfect God, Washington and his relationship with his slaves is an excellent book. Mm-hmm. And Jefferson's Pillow kind of touches on the same subject. But one of the things, whenever I look at Jackson's legacy, I'm well aware that American democracy would not have been the same without him. There is no ifs, ands, or buts about it. His contribution to that is paramount. But I have that same feeling about him. I mean, the legacy is so mixed. His banking policies guaranteed, like Jefferson, that the country would never be on a solid financial footing for decades to come. He certainly did not believe in the separation of powers when he had the fights with John Marshall on the Supreme Court. The massacres have always weighed heavily with me. And I have yet to resolve my opinion of Jackson. And one other point, by the way, Jackson had always had regretted that he had not hung John C. Calhoun. And that's a regret that I share. If anyone wow. deserved it at that period of time, Calhoun did.
Bill, let us pick it up from right there because our time begins to grow short and you've got a lot on the table. John Meacham, before you go to your bottom line, I wish you'd give us a thumbnail of these. The banking controversy, absolutely huge in his presidency. The separation of powers issues. I mean, we feel Bill's ambivalence about this president and the big chunk of American history with it. But just give us, in a nutshell, those two issues, banking, separation.
Let me give you those two. And I do want to offer one, if not bottom line mm-hmm. thought, at least mm-hmm. low to ground mm-hmm. thought. Yes. The bank war was... with nullification, with the struggle with South Carolina and with Indian removal, the defining crisis of the period.
He fought Jackson against the National Bank.
The second bank of the United States, run by Nicholas Biddle. He could not have found two Americans more different than Nicholas Biddle, who was a highly cultivated, polished man, and Andrew Jackson. Jackson saw, and perhaps to the country's detriment, he saw the struggle with the bank, I believe, as a political one. He did not like the idea that there were any intermediary institutions that really that stood between him and the people, or in a slightly more benign light, anything that he believed could corrupt the body politic. And in this, he was very much a classical Republican in that he believed the virtue of the country was entirely dependent on the virtue of the people. And if, in fact, you had concentrated interests who could infect that body and corrupt it, you were headed toward the end of the Republican, the American experiment.
Sounds he relevant believed, today, but the economy just fell off a cliff when he got done with his business.
He believed, you know... his great veto message in 1832, and this is where he takes on the bank to destroy it. He believed that having public money throwing off profit for private shareholders and a bank that made political contributions that retained Daniel Webster, for instance. Webster once wrote a note to Biddle saying it would be good to have my retainer refreshed, and I think that had some connection to the passion with which he defended the bank. But Jackson wrote what in many ways is kind of the urtext of our kind of populism when he said, "It is to be regretted that the rich and powerful too often bend the acts of government to their selfish purposes. And when the laws undertake to make the rich richer and the potent more powerful, the farmers, mechanics, and laborers, who have neither the time nor the means of securing like favors to themselves, have a right to complain of the injustice of their government. That's Andrew Jackson in 1832. Mm-hmm. So that's the bank war. The separation of powers is absolutely fascinating because you have him asserting himself as first among equals as president. He did defy the Supreme Court. There were all sorts of technicalities that we could spend the rest of the day on about how ultimately it was not quite as naked a defiance as has come down in history with. But like Lincoln, what impressed me most about getting to know Jackson's philosophy of the presidency was that he did believe that there were always remedies. There were always elections. There were always ways to pull a president or anyone else back from the brink and back into the mainstream. And so his sense was that the people were always ultimately in the right and would find their way to the right.
But an imperial presidency may have grown in part of the way he wielded his view toward that. John Meacham, we need another round with you. Maybe we'll get it one day. I certainly hope so. It's a wonderful biography, American Lion, Andrew Jackson in the White House. Thanks for your time today. We'll have to have you back and pursue it right on down through history. Thank you so much, John.
I'm very grateful.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.